Here are two words that I do not like speaking out loud, and those would be climate change. It just kind of, let me say, it just kind of sucks, right? It just sounds like the forecast is so daunting, it's so overwhelming, and how do we put it in simple terms for someone like myself who's kind of a novice on the subject? I mean, I have a feeling, I have thoughts, emotions about it, but how does that play out in real-world terms, and what can I do? Well, this isn't about necessarily doing a global action, but it is something that you could start looking at in your own region and perhaps in your own orchard or on your own apple trees. We're going to be hearing a pre-recorded presentation as done by Elizabeth Garofalo at CiderCon 2022. And before you scroll past and say, forget about it, I want to really encourage you to hang in there. It might seem kind of like basic to some folks, but it really helped me understand a bit more about what's going on in the orchard and to look for some telltale signs. Because some of the things that she's talking about, you're probably seeing not only on your apple trees, but you might be seeing it on your tomato plants. What happens to one plant can happen to many plants when it comes to climate change and the pathogens that it fosters. Ooh. Anyways, if whether you are a gardener to an orchardist, this episode is for you.
Hey, apples, make them pop. Pop, 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 pop.
Hey, 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 my name is Rhea Windcaller, and I am the producer and cider MC of this weekly podcast, where we speak with makers, cider enthusiasts, and folks within the cider trade from around the world. I've been talking with the folks at Fermentis to set up the upcoming recording of an episode all on yeast in June. Which means that this is your reminder to send any question that you might have on this topic my way to info@ciderchat.com. So far, there's questions on wild fermentation blended in with a cultured yeast, which I think a lot of people do. And I'm kind of curious if there's any tips on that from Fermentis, how to manage that. And then there's also on different yeast strains to work with and malolactic fermentation and the inoculation of malolactic bacteria and what timing you should do that inoculation of MLB or malolactic bacteria. So cool stuff coming. If you have a question, this is your opportunity. And if you want your name redacted, I will do that. It's fine. You could do it anonymously. It's cool. And send it their way, and we'll have a conversation for that upcoming episode. And just in case you're wondering who is Fermentis, well, perhaps you have had a package of yeast that has said Le Saffron. That's all part of the same company. So Fermentis by Le Saffron, they're all under the same umbrella. And what they provide is yeast and fermentation solutions for beverages. Therefore, they have solutions for cider and select cider yeast. You can find out all about them at fermentis.com. Coming up this September 18th through the 24th is a Totally Cider tour to both Normandy and Brittany with me and other fun-loving cider folks. And I want to tell you, there are both commercial makers and just enthusiasts who are going to be coming on this tour. So it's open to everyone. And this is your early notification that it's going to be going live soon for reservations at the end of this month of April 2022. I'm super stoked to kick off Normandy, our first night there in Honfleur, which is a harborside town. It's gorgeous. It's where artists go to, and Parisians love to vacation at because it's just this dreamy, magical place. And there we're going to be staying in the old section of town, which is like right next to the harbor. And we're going to be having our first cider dinner that evening with a guest maker in attendance. And she lives locally, and her name is Agathe Letier. I had her on episode 49. I'll put a link in the show notes. And she kind of became famous for this kind of belly laugh experience. Let's listen to that next. Oh, and by the way, let me just say that I was telling her about American cider and what we do with our cider.
raspberries in cider. They're putting ginger in cider. They're putting coffee in cider. Everything that you can imagine.
You drink your cider at the breakfast now.
Well,
that's
why not?
A good idea. Why not? To expand.
Well, also
your cider for the breakfast. In your coffee.
But that's a little bit.
That's a good idea.
Well, it's a little higher. It's a little. Oh my gosh. Every time I hear that, I just go into hysterics listening about it. Anyways, that gives you a flavor of who she is. She's super fun loving and she's a fantastic cider maker, also a producer of Calvados and Pommeau, as most of the makers are there. They're always blending a complement of products. So we'll be having a cider dinner with Agathe Letellier, and yow, what a way to kick off our time in Normandy. We'll be going live for reservations at the end of this month here, April. So start checking your calendar, and if you are interested and want to get that really, really early bird notification, send an email to info@ciderchat.com and let us know that you're interested, because right now we have a nice complement of people who are interested in going, a range of just aficionados to commercial makers. So this Totally Cider Tour, it's definitely for you.
Strange apples, bitter sharp.
It's time now for our featured presentation on climate change and apple disease as presented at CiderCon 2022 by Elizabeth Garofalo. Throughout this presentation, Liz was referring to a slideshow presentation, and I will be narrating and editing in different commentary on the slides to give you an idea in real time of what we were viewing. But do know at the Cider Chat YouTube channel, I have synced the slideshow with the audio for this presentation. So you could go there, just Google Cider Chat on YouTube and check it out. And while you're there, do subscribe to the Cider Chat YouTube channel, which certainly will notify you whenever a new video gets uploaded, but it also really helps this podcast gain visibility. There's still a lot of people that don't realize that there is a cider podcast like Cider Chat, and I'm really counting on you folks out there in Ciderville for sharing that good news. And one more thing on this PowerPoint presentation, there is a link in the show notes to this here episode 315, and you yourself could download the PowerPoint too and listen along. So without further ado, let's all grab a glass and join this chat with Elizabeth Garofalo speaking about climate change and apple disease as recorded at CiderCon 2022.
Hello, everyone. My name is Liz Garofalo. I'm an Extension educator with the UMass Fruit Program. I've been with Extension for about 7 years. I started by counting apple scab ascospores in the spring and very early summer in Dr. Dan Cooley's lab. And believe it or not, that actually kept me around. Now it's not my favorite task, it's a little tedious, but still important work, as apple scab is a big issue for our growers with apples in the Northeast. Not going to actually talk about apple scab today. We've pretty much identified all of the climatic factors that affect apple scab. We're familiar with it, we're comfortable with it. We know sort of how it works most of the time. However, we are starting to see, especially in my area in Massachusetts, we're starting to see bitter rot, which those of you from further south are familiar with, and powdery mildew starting to pop up more and more in our orchards. Now, in the past, we've seen these diseases, but they haven't really been something that's caught our eye. That's starting to change. So I'm going to start out talking a little bit about sort of the big picture of where we are with our climate, and then I'll go into how that affects these diseases and sort of some of the things that we can do about that. Overall, our global temperature is rising. Now, this here, if we were to look at this up close, we would see this line of zero here, and this line of zero indicates that there's no change occurring. If everything was going on as if it had always gone on, you would just see those lines that you see there tracking right with that black dotted line. That, of course, is not what we're seeing in our climate these days. So what we have here is this other black line I want to point out to you, because this is our observed temperatures. And as you can see, these observed temperatures continue to rise away from that zero point, which means they're continuing to get more and more different than they used to be.
Elizabeth noted that between the years 1901 to 2016, there was a 1.8 Fahrenheit increase in temperature, and that 1.2 of that total increase happened between 1982 and 2016. And I believe this means that we can assume from 1901 to 1982 that there was only a 0.6 increase versus a 1.2 total increase between 1982 and 2016.
So, you know, 1.8 degrees might not sound like all that much, but put it into context, 5 to 9 degrees cooler, the Northeast was covered in 3,000 feet of ice. So it does make a difference in those little increments.
Up next, she's referring to slide number 3 in this presentation, and what we're looking at are two graphs, one for Massachusetts and the other for Virginia. On both graphs, we're looking at observed and projected temperature change over time, and the length of time is from 1900 to 2100. So that's over the course of 200 years. And there is a black line at the 0.0 level, and then there is an orange line that begins to rise.
Black line, this is the line of no change. We know at this point that we're not going to hang out on that line. We're going to talk about how we've shifted away from that line. So on this side here, you see the orange line indicates what we are observing in temperatures in Massachusetts. We're seeing a 3.5 degree increase annually in Massachusetts. That orange line is continuing to go up. Now here in these red and these green, these are our projections. This is what is estimated to be coming our way based on climate data, based on emissions data, and sort of two different scenarios that are higher emissions scenarios and another scenario that says if we reduce our emissions, then we'll have less change. So on both of those, you see those green and red, that's the same thing there. The projection remains the same. The difference here is in that Massachusetts, we've got this 3.5 degrees. Virginia is only on average up 1.5 degrees. So this is interesting when you are thinking about regional challenges that you experience as an apple grower. And typically, like in Massachusetts, we don't think about the things that somebody in Virginia might think about on a regular basis. But now we do. Rain is changing too. Globally, we have seen an increase of 1/10 of an inch every year, or every decade rather, excuse me. We're now up about annually 2 inches on average. Used to be that it was approximately 42.9 inches per year. That's all changing. The contiguous U.S. is up as well. Now that's got a really big caveat attached to it, right? So when you talk about the Northeast, yes, we're seeing an increase in temperatures, but if you talk about the Southwest, the West Coast, rain is a real challenge out there. So all of these changes are going to affect different areas differently. One of the challenges in the Southwest area is that the temperatures have risen such that they're losing, their water resources are no longer as sound as a result of the temperature rise, not so much a change in the precipitation. So in Virginia, obviously there's a lot of different geographical landmarks. There's the ocean, there's the mountains, there's rivers, there's all of these things affect the way our climate affects us. And so it's very difficult to pin down within a state of that nature exactly how this precipitation and other parameters are changing. But we do have this overall average that we can look at. And one of the things that Virginia is seeing is it's seeing an increase in rain and a decrease in snow. When we get rain, it's not in a nice, easy pattern. You know, like one day we get a sweet little downfall or downpour, nice, happy, next day dry, next day rains. We're seeing an increase in extreme events. That's that two inches plus that you see here. We're seeing, on average in Virginia, 1.7 days more of these extreme rain events. In Massachusetts, we're seeing a similar shift, but again, we're seeing it a little bit more. We're seeing more than 2 days of extreme rain events, greater than we used to experience in the past. So we're seeing more rain, but it's not coming in a way that's necessarily helpful. So we have extended periods of dry, punctuated by downpours. What happens when you see something like that? You get erosion, you have stress in your crops, and you have the opportunity for different organisms that thrive under dry or wet conditions to both become happy in that environment. I'm going to focus on disease today, but it's not just diseases that are becoming more challenging in our orchards because of this change. We are seeing an influx of invasive species that are thriving now. They're not coming here because of climate change. They're coming here because we have global economy, and so we have shipping containers and people who move all around the world, and those insect pests especially are really good at moving with them. But when they get here, they find climates that are conducive to their survival. Spotted lanternfly, brown marmorated stink bug, kudzu vine is now starting to creep further north as well. So these are all things that affect our orchards as a result of the changing climate that we're seeing. The personal discomfort index was actually a kind of a joke amongst pathologists that had come up as a result of fire blight. Fire blight is obviously another disease that affects apple, and in the cider industry it's a really big challenge for us. But this personal discomfort index suggested that if you go outside and you feel a little swampy, it's really good fire blight weather if there's flowers out.
Up next, we're looking at a slide that is titled Personal Discomfort Index. And we see a map of the East Coast of the United States and Massachusetts. Over time, slowly the state gets superimposed over different areas going south along the border, so that in more recent years, the temperature is looking a lot like New Jersey.
I suggest that personal discomfort index is now becoming more relevant to the rest of the diseases that we are dealing with. One of the things that is being projected by these climate scientists is that the way it feels outside, not just the temperatures, but the actual feel of the atmosphere, is becoming more and more like that of what we would see in New Jersey.
Continuing to look at the same map of the East Coast of the U.S., and there's two green dots she's going to be referring to. One green dot is up in Franklin County, Massachusetts, and the other green dot she's going to be referring to is based in Richmond, Virginia, where CiderCon was taking place in 2022.
And now I've got these green dots up here just to sort of put a little frame of reference. This is, give or take, my house. And again, give or take, that's where we are. So to put into perspective what I'm accustomed to in terms of my climate, where I live, the estimations are come 2069, I'm going to be living here.
We continue to look at that same slide of the East Coast of the United States, and what we're seeing over time, that Massachusetts temperature continues to get warmer and warmer, so that by 2069, we see on the map Massachusetts is superimposed over Virginia.
I am not a southerner. I love it down here, but it gets really hot. If I am that uncomfortable with the idea of being that much warmer, consider how our crops are going to respond to that situation. We have this problem that we have to deal with. How do we deal with it? Well, when any time you deal with somebody who is producing food, the answer is, and IPM applies to other things too, but I'm a food person. So, integrated pest management is our answer. So 5th century BC, Sun Tzu wrote The Art of War. Now, I'm sure there's somebody, most of you in this room are familiar with The Art of War and the know thyself, know thy enemy quote, right? Well, what many people don't realize is that it goes on beyond that. And it's know thyself, know thy enemy, and fear not the outcome of 100 battles. Every time you go out for the season, you are going to fight 100 battles to bring your crops in, be it cider fruit, milk, what have you. You're going to have to fight these 100 battles of all of these pests and all of these challenges that face you as a grower to get that crop economically and environmentally soundly to your consumer. Sun Tzu I like to think of as the original practitioner of IPM. Now, granted, he was dealing with people, but the concepts that he was talking about remain the same. If you understand the enemy that you're dealing with, and we've already started to talk about this a little bit in terms of the climate factors that we're dealing with, if you understand your enemy, you will be able to effectively fight that enemy off, and integrated pest management is the arsenal that you have with which to do that. So knowledge is definitely power. I know that's a trite statement, but it's true, and it remains true for us as well. Understanding, as I've just said, your enemy helps you have power over it. One of the things that we use as pathologists is this disease triangle.
I do enjoy how Elizabeth is bringing a bit of levity to a very serious situation. This next slide that she's referring to with a triangle is titled Mini Plant Pathology 101, or as she has on the side, Thy Enemy. And in the center of the triangle is disease. And on the three different corners of the triangle, at the base, you see susceptible host and favorable environment. And then on the top is pathogen. And she's going to be describing this triangle next.
And this disease triangle tells us that if you have a susceptible host, a virulent pathogen, and a favorable environment, you will have disease. And so we use this as a framework to think about how to disrupt the disease process. If you interrupt the pathogen in some way, you're going to interrupt your disease process. You're going to reduce or eliminate your disease pressure. Likewise for favorable environment or susceptible host. So as we think about disease and climate, keep that triangle in the back of your mind and think about how that is going to work into the way that you deal with your challenges in your orchard moving forward. So I told you we were going to talk about powdery mildew. So now these disease names are really generic. Powdery mildew, fire blight, anthracnose. They don't really tell you what is causing the problem. They tell you what you're seeing the problem as. In other words, the plant's response to the problem is the disease. So what we need to do is we need to know which actual pathogen we're dealing with. And so that's why powdery mildew is real tricky, because there are a number of different pathogens that cause powdery mildew on a plethora of hosts. It can get onto soybean, cucumbers, squash, lilacs, zinnias. We literally don't have time for me to sit here and list them all off for you today, and you'd be bored, so I won't. But as many different hosts as there are different pathogens as well. It's Encinula nicator. And I think that's unfortunate, because Eurysifee is a much prettier name for a pathogen.
Once again, we're getting a little bit of levity from Elizabeth as we're looking at slide number 11, which is titled A Rose by Any Other Name. It states powdery mildew is a somewhat generic disease name. And on a grape, she's making mention here that there was a name change. Formerly, it had the name Eurysifee, and now it's called Encinula.
Cherry and plum, we get a little closer to the pathogen that we're dealing with. We're now dealing with that Podocera genus. And then again, in apricot, nectarine, and peach, we're in that same genus as what we're going to be dealing with apples. The pathogen that causes powdery mildew on apple is this Podocera leucotrica. It affects the whole tree. Buds, shoots, fruits. It gets into the terminals and overwinters there. It can be very challenging in a number of different ways, not least of all because if you have an infected apple block and you have a peach block nearby, you're going to start to see that in your peach as well. So it's not entirely host specific. As it relates to cider fruit, this, not that big a deal, right? You're going to squish it. That part's going to go away. It's going to be like it was never there. We're not worried about that piece so much.
What Elizabeth is describing is the appearance of the outer skin of the apple. And what it looks like on the slide here in particular is that it's kind of a mottled, white, veiny appearance on the outer skin.
But when we start talking about having our shoots stunted, when we start talking about having our buds open later than healthy buds, then we're starting to get worried whether we're growing cider fruit or dessert fruit. If you talk about increased susceptibility to winter damage, again, regardless of which industry you're in for where your fruit goes, this is a concern. Reduced flower bud formation, a wicked problem with cider fruit because we already have an issue with biennialism. We do not need to add a pathogen that's going to reduce our flower set. our production either. And of course, if the fruit gets stunted, we're not very happy with that either. Again, know your enemy. Be able to identify it. You can have various things that occur on your trees that might look like one thing or the other, but powdery mildew is pretty readily identified because, you know, the name is pretty basic because its appearance is pretty basic. It's a mat of powdery mycelium. You're seeing the spore on the mycelium that are going to then eventually distribute to the rest of the trees and cause further infection. So that's how you know in the orchard. And it tends to show up on the terminal shoots because it's overwintered in those terminal buds, and we'll talk about that next. Powdery mildew infects shoots, and then the mycelium stays there so that when it goes into overwintering, it's in those buds that are waiting to break the next spring. So it goes into these buds here from later infections, and then in the spring, it opens up, and it's a really smart pathogen, right? So this pathogen is like, well, I'm going to infect this shoot, and then next year, I'm going to sleep in so that everybody else is already awake, and when my shoot wakes up, I have susceptible tissue to land on and cause infection. Pathogens are tricky. So once it gets here, it can continuously reinfect throughout the whole season. You know, you get that initial infection that comes from those overwintered mycelium. The spore go from there to fresh tissue. From there, it causes lesions, goes to new tissue, and so on all season long, provided that climate is favorable and the host is susceptible. One of the things that's interesting about powdery mildew is most of our pathogens require water for infection. Powdery mildew actually will not sporulate or germinate under wet conditions. It likes it humid and it likes it warm, but it doesn't like it wet. The rain can actually wash the spore away and it can suppress their germination. The optimum temperature, and this is going to be a thread that I kind of harp on as we move forward, this optimum temperature for infection. It's the optimum temperature for infection, but it's not the only temperature at which infection can occur. And keep in mind when these optimum temperatures are we're accustomed to seeing these temperatures.
So here we're looking at slide number 16, and it's titled Infection Conditions. And she's saying optimum temperature of 66 degrees Fahrenheit to 72 degrees Fahrenheit, which translates to Celsius being 19 degrees Celsius to 22 degrees Celsius. Just to kind of keep that in context, wherever you are in the world and whatever temperature scale you're using.
Bitter rot is a little complicated, and I'm sorry, I'm going to apologize for that pun because I will continue to make it over and over and over again. There are two complexes that cause bitter rot in apple, and they're complex because they have multiple species within the complex that cause disease. So again, going to apologize. I'm just going to keep up with that pun. Colitopticum gliosporoides is typically seen more often in our southerly regions. This particular complex of species likes it hot, and I'm afraid I'm going to have to stick with the scientific names because there are so many species within these complexes that there's no easy... If I said bitter rot, then I would be talking about both of these complexes, and that's not very effective. So, gliosporoides, more southerly pathogen complex, causes disease. This is a thing that we've known for a really long time. Scientists and extension educators in the South are very familiar with it. They are able to help their growers work really well with it. When you move a little further north, we're not really seeing gliosporoides. We're seeing Acutatum. Acutatum has a different set of species, or species within its genus and within its complex. And each species has the potential to have different ideal temperature ranges. So understanding what's in it in this complex and how those species respond to temperature is really important. Again, there is a completely unknowable number of hosts for this, and this is one of the reasons why it does make it such a complex problem, because it can go from being a organism that just lives quietly on a leaf to being a hyper-virulent organism on fruit.
Here we're looking at slide number 17, and it has a really great image of bitter rot on an apple. And it looks like a wound on the apple. It's like an indentation on the apple, and it has like little concentric circles going inward to the center.
This one is, in terms of identification, it's a little more difficult to identify this one than it is powdery mildew. Powdery mildew is pretty obvious. Bitter rot can often be confused for other diseases or physiological disorders. So understanding the difference between those is important. I'll talk about a couple of the key differences here in a minute. But black rot's a common disease in the Northeast. We don't see it very often because it's a weak pathogen. Bitter pit, we see an awful lot in Honeycrisp.
Here we're looking at slide number 19, and it is displaying black rot on an apple. And it is mostly a nice-looking apple, except that there's a big circle that looks like the concentric rings that one would see on a tree stump. It isn't necessarily indented, whereas bitter rot is an indentation on the apple.
In the Northeast, we see black rot more often as this frog eye leaf spot over here. And we don't really worry about that. That doesn't do much to our fruit. It comes, it goes. Again, it's a weak pathogen. But we do see this. This is a little more concerning when you see this sloughing bark on your, especially on your high densities. But again, that typically tends to sort of work its way out. Black rot on Kingston black is a little bit more concerning, especially if it becomes more problematic. But here's the thing that I want you to focus on. These concentric rings, you'll see those again, but these are a little different in that they're brown, and you're not going to see as distinct a sporulation in those concentric circles as you will with the bitter rot. The other thing that's really interesting to note is the way the rot goes into the fruit. It goes in an indistinct shape and goes straight into that seed cavity. And you'll see with bitter rot that that's not how that works.
Next, we'll be hearing about bitter pit. And with bitter pit on an apple, you would see it as little black pock marks all over the apple. So it kind of looks like a dice, that kind of like little black mark on a dice, but many of them all over an apple.
So again, bitter pit, I mentioned it's a physiological disorder. I believe up until recently, nobody knew what actually caused it, but there's now some thought going around that there's a sorbitol deficiency in the leaves that's causing a sink of the calcium from the fruit, because it's calcium that's causing the issue ultimately in the fruit. But so with the bitter pit, it's not rot, and you can tell that it's kind of dry. The fruit's kind of dry underneath the skin, whereas with the black rot, it's definitely rotten. I have not tested this, and I don't recommend that you do either, but it is supposed to actually taste bitter. Not a really great diagnostic key for the field, so you don't want to make things like that. So the other thing that's good to take into consideration with bitter pit is that it tends to occur on the lower half of the fruit because the calcium is just not getting out there through the vascular tissue. So here's bitter rot. This is what it starts out with looking like, with this red halo around it. Just a little bitty sunken spot on the fruit. When you get a lot of them, they start to coalesce, and eventually you'll end up with this big old rotten, gnarly mass. And on it, you can see those concentric sporulating rings. And they're typically salmon-colored with bitter rot. But this is really the thing that I like to look for. This is a very clearly different than black rot. So if you see this, you're dealing with bitter rot, not black rot. But this is another one of those really key characteristics, because the others don't do that. That very defined conical shape of rot going into the center of the fruit. The life cycle of bitter rot is not quite as well understood as the powdery mildew one is. So I mentioned that there were different species within each complex, different complexes that cause disease. This is a hypothesized life cycle of C. farinae, which is one of the species within the Acutatum complex, right? So that's one that we know exists in the Northeast. There have been scientists recently who have identified it in the Hudson Valley and in Pennsylvania and other states, other regions in that area, locations in that area. the last known identification of this particular species in Massachusetts, in Connecticut, was actually associated with an insect pest. So not only does this thing go on to other plant hosts, but it can go on to insects as well. And so that's a real challenge, because if that insect goes from one place to another, it's going to spread the spore as well. But what we do know is that the tree doesn't start out with a bitter rot infection. Those pathogens are in the overwintering mummies, which is what you see here. And this is a mummy in the process of being formed. You can actually see those concentric sporulating rings on that. So this is going to dry up, hang on the tree, and next year spore is going to come off of that, and you're going to have new infection. But it also can come from the long leaf plantain that's in your orchard floor. It can come from the hedgerow that is next to your orchard, because this particular pathogen can live epiphytically, which means it just, like I said before, it just sits there. It doesn't necessarily do anything. It's not deriving nutrients from a host. It's just existing on the surface of a leaf, for example. And when it gets splash dispersed to a susceptible host, back to that triangle, you end up with infection. Assuming, of course, that the environment is favorable as well. So the infection can initiate, but then sort of not develop. So you could potentially have an infection occur, and you wouldn't even know it for another month or two because it's gone quiet, because the conditions for the actual development of the disease piece aren't conducive. So when we're dealing with bitter rot, we do need a rain event, a relative humidity that's pretty high, 80 to 100%. I mentioned earlier that one of the reasons that we have a different complex in the north than we do in the south is that there is a difference in the optimal temperature for their disease development and infection. So that Gleosporides optimally about 86 degrees, whereas with Acutatum optimally about 77. We do have spores germinating in free water, unlike that powdery mildew, which wouldn't germinate with free water. Some of the information that we have available to us is good, but could be better. For example, one of the reasons that we have some of this temperature data is that scientists have been doing like wound inoculations in the lab and in the field, which ensures that you develop disease, but it's not a natural situation, because this pathogen can penetrate healthy tissue. So it does not have to have a wound. Of course, it helps. But in its natural environment, it can infect apples without having to have any sort of damage done to it, the fruit. Typically, again, in the past, we haven't seen these infections occurring during our bloom time because the weather is just not that good for it. That's starting to change. Our increase in precipitation in the Northeast, it's not consistent. And so what we're seeing this year, actually, what we saw was we had a drought at the beginning of the season, which was great for apple scab, and because it made it easier to manage, right? Less rain, less apple scab infections, great. Less rain, more powdery mildew infections, unfortunately, however, we discovered. So we started the season out abnormally dry to drought conditions throughout the majority of Massachusetts, as well as New England, for that matter. And they stayed further north in drought conditions for the better part of the summer. We ended up around July 11th starting to see our average accumulation exceed our annual average, historical average. So beginning on July 11th, that rain event that occurred on that day, our average for the year had exceeded what we'd normally expect. It continued to exceed our average each time it rained, to the point where in Belchertown, which is where our research orchard is, we were up a total of 4.5 inches for the year. In Greenfield, where I live, we were up 7.25 inches, and I can attest to that because it was a sloppy yard year. And it was challenging for our trees because we have these trees in these ground. The ground for myself, I just put in like 20 trees that I grafted, and I'm like, yay, they all survived. And black stem borer comes in because waterlogged trees are stressed trees. They tend to draw in pests. All of that because of the rain. So I mentioned the variability from site to site, you know, like state to state, region to region. It's very site specific. So across Massachusetts, to give you a sense of how relatively small a space can experience relatively large differences. Out in Berkshire County here, which is where the mountains are, we're up 7.74 degrees Fahrenheit on average, right? Our growing season is on average 11 days longer than it used to be, which should be good, but remember, this is an average. We're not dealing with the increase on a consistent or regular basis. So Franklin County, that's up here, is up about 5 days. Now, that's from the difference of that county there to that county there, from 11 to 5 in our average growing season days. When you get out to Nantucket, for example, out on this island here, there's no change on average. So it's really important to understand that when you're, especially if you're growing apples, if you have a farm, the changes that you experience in your orchard are not necessarily going to be the same as those that your neighbor 2 hours, 3 hours, a mountain range away is going to experience. What do we do to deal with that? We have forecast models. Now, there are forecast models for any number of different things. I tend to think about them specifically as being for disease, horticultural events, and for weather. So that's all I'm going to talk about here today. But a model, it's this representation of what is occurring within an organism or within the framework of weather based on mathematical variables, right? And then we use these models to describe the likelihood of an infection event and its severity as it relates to disease. The common threads that we're dealing with here today, though, are degree day accumulations, which is a temperature accumulation, the developmental thresholds, basically a temperature below which no organismal activity occurs, precipitation, humidity, and biofix. So biofix is this significant event in a biological organism's life, right? So it's with a tree, we're talking green tip or bloom. With an insect pest, you might be talking about a nymphal stage or egg stage. There's this misconception, I think, in many of our communities that degree days are actually growth related. They are not. They are not growing degree days. Degree days can be used to assess the HVAC system in this building to determine whether or not they need to turn the heat up or down. It is strictly about accumulating temperature units. And they're a really useful tool for us to use for these models because we can use that information and put it into our systems and assess, again, this risk. One of the ways that you can do that on your site is by having an automated weather station. One of the many different models that you can have. I actually got one for Christmas this year, and it looks nothing like that. It's much smaller. but it's a piece of equipment that has, you know, you've got your wind sensor on it, you've got your leaf wetness sensor, you've got a UV sensor, you've got a rain gauge, all of these pieces of information that you would need to be able to feed into a model and have that model assess that data and provide a response to you. There are some downsides to these. They do require maintenance. They have a fee associated with them, both in its purchase, maintenance, and if you want to use one of these models that we have online available to us, which I'll talk about in a minute, you have to pay to have that data uploaded into their servers. You can see here one of the challenges, of course, is that rain gauge, which is what this is, has a wasp nest built onto the bottom of it. So it's really important to maintain your weather stations if you're going to get effective data out of your model that's using that data. So that information that we need to record is for both the host as well as the pathogen, whichever pathogen you might be dealing with, or insect pest for that matter. All of these different things, photo periods, temperature, precipitation, relative humidity, go into the model to give you this forecast that, depending on what you're dealing with, looks perhaps like this. So this is a output from a decision support system online called RIMPRO. This one does require that you pay a fee for it. But what you're seeing here is down here you've got this bar that shows you dark blue is rain, light blue is leaf wetness. leaf wetness matters because when we're talking about whether or not there's enough moisture on the surface of our host to cause the sporulation of the spores. So that's what that is here. Now here, specific to the powdery mildew, we have this that is telling us we have primary sporulating lesions. So with powdery mildew, you remember we talked about that, that mycelium overwintered on the shoots. So that's what that's talking about here, the spore that is being produced on that overwintering shoot. Now up here, we have a couple of different things going on, and it's talking about in the white that there's germinating conidia, germinating spore. In the yellow, it's talking about how those spore are airborne, right? So they are being able to move from infected site, already infected site, to uninfected site. And then, of course, the red bar indicates that there has been an infection, and this gives you a nice sense of like how severe that infection might be. And then up here, you see that you have those secondary infections are already starting to build up spore to cause additional secondary infections. The other thing that you'll notice here, down here on the bottom, is that you've got your dates. So if you were going to, for example, manage for powdery mildew in your orchard, you would look at this model and say, oh, wow, I better look out here because I need to get a protective fungicide on for that. I can't go in with a curative the way I can with scab, and I don't necessarily want to either. So having these models allows us to recognize that our climatic factors are changing and know when they're going to be occurring within a season such that we need to pay attention for management. Of course, planting less resistant varieties is one of the best ways that you can reduce your disease pressure in any given situation. So for powdery mildew, your more susceptible varieties are up here. So you've got Ida Red, Granny Smith, Ginger Gold, and Cortland are highly susceptible to powdery mildew. Down here on the lower end, and see, this is a little bit of good news, actually, because Fuji and Gala are, like, very popular varieties right now, or more people are starting to put those into the ground for dessert. But you might, if you have a powdery mildew issue, you might want to not think about putting those particular varieties into your orchard moving forward. Switch back to bitter rot. So bitter rot's really scary if you're not used to seeing it. I got an email from a chemical representative / consultant this summer, and he sends me this picture and he says, what is this? And I said, well, that's bitter rot. Well, I've never seen it this early in the year. No, we haven't. That's the problem, because we are not used to seeing this pathogen so early in the year that we aren't necessarily using materials in our commercial orchards that are going to protect us against it. And so we had at least 3 infection events in June when normally we are not even thinking about summer disease at all. There were 2 that were questionable, one in the very beginning and one at the very end. Probably a little too cold to actually have stimulated infection for that time. But what I suspect is that this grower here, who, by the way, ended up getting hosed with bitter rot in their Honeycrisp this year. I suspect that one of these events here established was quiescent, and then when conditions were further favorable, woke up and caused the issues that he experienced. And then, of course, continued to spread, because much like powdery mildew, as soon as these lesions start to put out spore, they go to susceptible tissue again. Cut out those mummies, because they are a source of inoculum. Make sure that your understory has been managed for weeds. You don't want to have a bunch of broadleaf weeds under your orchard trees if you don't have to, for a number of different reasons. I know we like to talk about pollinator services, but frankly, in terms of a conventional orchard, I want to keep them out because I don't want them to be in there on those broadleaf weed hosts while insecticides are being sprayed. So removing your broadleaf weeds both protects your pollinators and reduces your potential for inoculum development within the orchard. Dormant pruning, this gets to be an economy of scale kind of thing. If you have a small orchard or high-value varieties, you might want to identify where your powdery mildew strikes were so that you can go back in and prune them out. If you have a huge orchard and that's just not practical, probably not the practice you're going to use. Likewise with the removal of mummies. They're not known to survive on roots or in the soil. So the issue is that the epiphytic survival is on those broadleaf hosts. And again, cultivar selection. Unfortunately, with bitter rot, it loves Honeycrisp. Planting other varieties isn't always an option because Honeycrisp is what's making a lot of our orchards money these days. But there are an awful lot of others that are less susceptible. And again, a little bit of good news, Fuji, least susceptible. Do go check out New England Tree Fruit Management Guide. It is free online. And then the Northeast Cider Apple Project, which is why I'm here. And then the other thing that people might be interested in is this My IPM app. And it helps you with identification in the field. You download the app, you download your disease or your crop and the pest complex that you're interested in, and then you have pictures and you have recommendations that you can use. All right, well, thank you all for coming. It was wonderful to see you.
Powdery mildew, bitter rot, black rot, bitter pit. Ooh, all these things that just makes you want to like go into the house, pull down the shades, and lock the door. And thankfully, we have folks like Elizabeth Garenfellow doing her work. There'll be links where you could get a hold of her. And also don't forget a link to the PowerPoint presentation and the fact that this entire presentation is synced with the PowerPoint at the Cider Chat YouTube channel. For me, this was absolutely fantastic because I was finally able to like think about climate change and have a taste of it where I could take it in and not get overwhelmed. So kudos to Liz, and thank you for following along and listening to the end. So with that, for now, I'm going to leave you here until next time, Ciderville, because you need a little bit of time to look at your calendar and see if September 18th and 24th, you could come along to France, both Normandy and Brittany, with me. And with that, I leave you here. This is Real Windcaller, signing off for now. Looking forward to seeing you in Ciderville.
We like cider. Like palms, we love orchards and having fun. There is a reason.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason why we drink it like this.
Oh yes, there is. There is a reason. We like walking through the orchards, dancing in the streets, smelling all the blossoms, kicking up our feet. We like cider, we like palms, we like orchards, having some fun.
There is a reason.
There is a reason
why we do it like this. Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason why we drink it like this.
Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason. We like walking through the orchards, dancing in the streets, smelling all the blossoms, kicking up our feet.
Oh yeah.
We like cider.
Oh yes, we do.
We like palms.
Oh yes, we do.
We love orchards, having some fun.
There is a reason.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Ba-da-da-dum.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Ba-da-da-dum.
There is a reason why we drink it like this.
Ba-da-da-dum.
Ba-da-da-dum. We like walking down the orchards, dancing in the streets, smelling all the blossoms, kicking up our feet.
Oh yeah.
We like cider.
Ba-da-da-dum.
We like palms.
Oh yes, we do.
We like orchards, having some fun.
Yeehaw!